It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Sometimes when we seem to hear too many voices in our lives, we wish they'd all go away except for just the one comforting one. That seldom happens. We might be better off realizing that we aren't made of just one solo voice. We're a chorus of voices and wants and preferences, each speaking up at some time, the whole lot of them seldom agreeing. And we live as part of this sea of voices, trying to find a good path through the clatter. Sometimes we can just decide and do something whether the other voices like it or not. Ideally, we can be creative enough to do it together, bringing the whole choir along. That takes great talent and great patience. But if the Buddhists are right in saying we're more like choruses than soloists, and I think they are, then we need a home in our soul and in our world for all the voices within us. The brave, clear-thinking ones, the frightened ones, the compassionate voices that want to do the caring thing more than the right thing, voices that need to understand, and those wishing they could love even where they can't understand, and so many more voices within and around us looking for a welcoming home. In the meantime, and it seems a very long meantime, we stand where we are, silently praying, O God, O life, O universe, let us find a home where all of us, can live together in creative compassion. Just that, Amen. Sometimes music accompanies the sermon, sometimes sermon is accompaniment to the music. Today, I want to share some reflections on Leonard Bernstein and what he has to teach us. This is the first time that I'd heard the Chichester Psalms, but when Brent told me about the music, and then when I read the Psalms from which Bernstein took his lyrics, I recognized again one of his greatest and most unusual and troubling gifts as a composer. Bernstein made space for a huge variety of voices in his greatest works. The voices don't agree, and they aren't squeezed into a forced and phony kind of harmony. Instead, they're presented as a sort of in-your-face slice of life without a simple and clear solution. Here's what I mean. When I read through the 6 Psalms from which he took the lyrics for this piece, I wrote down the different voices and moods that I found going through them. Now, you heard them in Hebrew. In English, here are some of the voices that exist in just those 6 Psalms. There's the voice of God as a conqueror, sounding very triumphal. The voices of his people cover a huge spectrum, from excited, devoted, and loved, to fearful, rejected, abandoned by God, and inadequate. In the next lines, they're joyful, praising God, sounding comforted and fearless. Then they're very angry. You heard some of this in the music, with the men's voices coming in under the women's voices, when he was combining the women's voices singing Psalm 23 and the men's voices singing an angry line from the 2nd Psalm. There's also a voice of self-righteousness, eager to condemn outsiders. This is a voice speaking for a wrathful, furious, and vengeful God, one that's offering dominion of the earth, granting power to break opposing nations with a rod of iron and to dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel, as the psalmist says. And these lines are followed by voices that are thankful for God's goodness and mercy, which are followed by completely despondent voices. Then there's a withdrawn voice. For me, I think the most surprising voice in the bunch, saying it's just not concerned with high and hard demands, but it's satisfied to be calm, self-contained, and quiet. Finally, there's the voice of simple happiness, happy to be dwelling in unity with all others. You could get whiplash 3 times just following the moods and the voices in these 6 psalms. Even though you expect that they reflect the real human condition pretty much at all times and places. There's a normal tendency to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative and to try to harmonize all the voices with, well, truth be told, with our sense of harmony. And that's what most musical settings would do of the Psalms. But one of the characteristics of Leonard Bernstein's greatest music that's most appealing and most troubling is his ability to create a musical space within which many voices could coexist without being homogenized, leaving the troubling feeling for the audience to take home with them. Like that. He did this in West Side Story. All you have to do is compare the range and feel of music in West Side Story to any other musical you can think of. Think of Oklahoma. And then think of the range of music in West Side Story that you have just with the songs Tonight, Everything's Great in America, and The Vulgar Officer Krupke. Bernstein put these pieces together in ways no other composer that I know of ever did successfully. But he did it most dramatically, and he did it his very best in what I think was his very greatest stage work, The Mass. This piece was commissioned by the Kennedy family for the dedication of the Kennedy Center in 1971. Rose Kennedy, JFK's mother, hated what he wrote. Cardinal O'Connor wanted it banned as a heretical work and succeeded in getting its performances cut down. I saw the touring company production of the Mass in Detroit around 1975, and I could see why they might have hated it. Now, I wonder how many here saw a stage production of Bernstein's Mass? 1, 2, 3, 4. It's not quite like the CD version. Here was a Mass written by 2 Jews. A 53-year-old Leonard Bernstein at the peak of his genius and a 23-year-old Stephen Schwartz at the beginning of the flourishing of his genius. It's not really a Catholic Mass, even though it goes through the movements of the Catholic Mass. It contains scathing critiques of both the Church and the Mass and the religion for being irrelevant and incoherent. Bernstein showed a marvelous knowledge of history in it. In medieval times, Catholic Masses would have tropes inserted into them. These are things that had nothing to do with the Mass. They're tunes that were often drinking tunes taken from bars that the composer could write other sorts of words to and stick them in the Mass. It must have been much more fun attending Masses then than more lately. Bernstein knew this history, and he inserted tropes throughout his Mass as the major vehicles of his scathing critiques. For instance, one soloist interrupted the priest, and the priest... I'll tell you the plot of the Mass. You sit in a dark theater with quadraphonic speakers, and in the darkness you hear some choir singing in Latin from 4 different speakers, 4 different things that don't go together. that are as cacophonous as you can imagine, and this just keeps going on. Until at the same instant, four things happen. It's wonderful. Someone cuts the tape, thank God. A pin spot comes on, lighting up one tiny spot on the stage in which a young man is sitting in blue jeans and blue work shirt, holding a guitar, strumming the chord of the guitar, and beginning the first words of the Mass, which are, "Sing God a Simple Song." You've pretty much got the plot of the Mass right there. He loves singing God a simple song, so he decides to be a priest. Don't ask why. It's part of the story. But when he becomes a priest, now he's trying to do the Mass in Latin, and it's no longer a simple song. And in the opinion of many of the protesters, it's no longer to God either, or the world. So that's the tension. Now these protesters, these street singers, never let him finish a single part of the Mass. They interrupt everything he does. And the interruptions are Bernstein's critique, these other voices he's bringing in. So one soloist interrupts the Credo in Unum Deum to sing, "I'll believe in one God, I'll believe in three, I'll believe in 30 if they'll believe in me." It's not quite the Mass. Another interrupted the priest during the Gratias Deo, very poignant song, to say that she once thanked God. But now, somehow, it's strange, she sings. Though nothing much has really changed, I don't sing Gloria, I don't sing Gratias Deo. I can't say quite when it happened, but gone is the thank you. In a choral piece called God Said, one of many people's favorites because it's the most raucous, the choir only sings the real lyrics after the priest leaves the stage. These include the chorus, "And it was good, brother, and it was good, sister, and it was good, brother, and it was goddamn good." This is not your grandmother's Mass, unless she was one heck of an outspoken lady. Also in that song, the lyricist, Stephen Schwartz, wrote these words to give you a feel of some of the critique that Bernstein built in this Mass. "God said, take charge of my zoo. I made these creatures for you, so he won't mind if we wipe out a species or two. God said that sex should repulse unless it leads to results, and so we crowd the world full of consenting adults." "God said it's good to be meek, and so we are once a week. It may not mean a lot, but oh, it's terribly chic. God made us the boss. God gave us the cross. We turned it into a sword to spread the word of the Lord. We use his holy decrees to do whatever we please. And it was good, yeah, and it was good, yeah, and it was goddamn good." That's Bernstein's Mass. Finally, the protesters torment the priest to the point that he flings down the chalice, smashes it on the stage, tears off his robe, throws it at them, and leaves the stage. Then I think one of the most stunning moments in the entire Mass came. I was sitting next to a friend of mine who was a rabid, frothing-at-the-mouth secular humanist. And every time the protesters came out, he'd cheer. And I would say, "Jim, I don't think they're going to win. I don't think this is going to be about them." "Oh, they're right. Listen to that. They're just, you know." After the priest left the stage, what a stunning moment it was. It was all visual. All of the protesters suddenly fell to the stage like puppets who had all had their strings cut. It turns out they had no message. They had no answer. They only had complaints. And they needed the priest to play off of. Stunning. They sat there for a while, and then a little child came out and picked up the guitar that had started the whole thing. And he tried to pick out that simple song, and they could handle that. It turns out these people needed to be led after all. And then the priest comes back, but in blue jeans and a work shirt. sits on the stool, takes the guitar, and leads the masses in the simple song, but not all of them. One very angry street person, he was wonderful, refused to take any part in this hokum, and he went upstage and stood there as a solitary figure with a fury that filled the entire theater. You could not take your eyes off him. Meanwhile, the priest sitting on the stool is leading the rest of the masses through the simple song. At the end of it, the priest says, "The mass is ended, go in peace," whereupon the soul figure upstage gives the finger to the priest and the audience and leaves the stage, and that's the end of the Bernstein Mass. This is not your grandmother's Mass. Many voices, given space to coexist, brought into proximity, but not harmony. Bernstein did that better than anyone. And it was just like real life. You can understand why Rose Kennedy might have hated it. Bernstein gave her a masterpiece that was far more than she'd bargained for. He gave her not an orthodox voice, but many voices brought together on the same stage to sing their very different songs in their very different passionate voices and to be heard, perhaps even revered, but not resolved, ever. Cardinal O'Connor thought that was bad. Most churches, frankly, would think it's bad. No real liberal church could think it's bad, no matter how uncomfortable it would be. And no Unitarian church in touch with its history could think it's bad, no matter how uncomfortable it may be. The range of voices we have in Unitarian churches and in America is immense. And like the voices in Bernstein's works, they're not resolved. They're in proximity, but not in harmony, on a huge range of topics. A couple months ago, we learned just how wide the range of opinions was we have right here on 9/11. I was very clear that I think our government either let 9/11 happen on purpose or made it happen on purpose. Some others agreed. Some others thought that is the craziest idea they have ever heard in their life. Our government would never do such a thing. Others are somewhere in between, and others, the majority, I suspect, really want to say, there is so much going on in my life that really demands attention, that's the last thing I even care to think about. But the whole range of voices is here, sitting right next to you. They've been sitting next to you for years. They're all around you. No matter what you believe on something that important, you're surrounded by people, many of whom do not share your beliefs and may not even respect them. Many voices. They exist here in proximity, but not harmony. And that's one of the most frustrating and magical things, not only about liberal churches, but about, if only it would work well, America. And the different political beliefs in this room, my God, they simply pale in comparison to the different religious beliefs sitting here. You want to see discord? My goodness, we have members for whom Jesus Christ really is the Son of God, at least in deep, symbolic, and poetic ways. We have members for whom religion is and will always be about God, understanding God, trying to serve God. And they mean the God of the Bible, no matter how liberally or metaphorically they may be taking it. Others have bad memories of that God, but find inspiration through stories of some of the ancient goddesses. Very different religion. We have others for whom the whole idea of either gods or goddesses is somewhere between useless and repulsive. People who might say we're called to be decent people and to make the world a better place, but who do it without ever needing to think about Jesus or gods. We have a few for whom the structures of Hinduism are their center, with its rich tapestry of stories, its rich array of so many imaginative depictions of some of the creative, sustaining, and destructive powers of the universe. We have others who, if asked, would identify themselves as Buddhists, but not all the same kind of Buddhists. Some here believe in an afterlife, some don't. Some believe in reincarnation and believe that they're not now in either their first or their last incarnation. Others here think that's just crazy, that it all starts, happens, and ends right here and now. Now, if you haven't heard your own beliefs so far, you can just add them. And then about 50 more permutations and combinations to flesh out the rest of the myriad beliefs that are sitting right here in this room and in virtually every church in America. That's the world Leonard Bernstein kept putting into his music. That world of many differing voices in proximity but not harmony, and part of his genius was resisting the temptation to try and force them into a false harmony. So I think some of Bernstein's greatest pieces were practically written for liberal churches. But not only for us. Our whole country would be better off if they had that ability to tolerate profound differences on important topics. Like they were to Rose Kennedy and Cardinal O'Connor, too many divergent opinions on important matters like religion are very upsetting to a lot of people. The truth is, no matter how uncomfortable this truth is, the truth is most of us would be far more comfortable in a world fashioned on the right beliefs, which luckily are ours. And during the past few years, we've all heard some of the most strident voices in America insisting that all beliefs do need to be harmonized with the right beliefs, which happen to be theirs. They want harmony in our country and think that can only come from getting all the voices to sing the same song. That's wrong. It would be incredibly boring music, as well as a foolish and a very dangerous society. We need to learn something, and Leonard Bernstein could teach it to us. He could teach us that the real art in music and in life doesn't come from trying to stamp everyone with the same cookie cutter, to make them as alike as dead interchangeable machine parts. The real art lies in the ability to create an atmosphere in which all God's children, all the wonderful and crazy quilt variety of nature, all the wonderful people, including the screwballs who gather here and other places, can all live in a creative proximity rather than a destructive one. The kind of harmony we need in life isn't that of pretending that all opinions or all people can be made to fit the same mold. They can't. The kind of harmony we need in life comes through the art of creating the atmosphere that lets our many differences exist together in creative proximity. Not indifferent proximity, not passive-aggressive proximity, not actively aggressive proximity, not destructive proximity, creative proximity. It's a much higher art than just stomping on people with cookie cutters. It takes grown-up people secure enough in their own beliefs to welcome people who don't share those beliefs, even though they share our humanity, our need for peace, our need for understanding, our need for justice, and our need for compassion. And in this great mix of life, no deep harmony is possible unless we can first grow past the clamoring for a shallow harmony, which can never exist anyway. That's the vision needed and the art to see beyond superficial differences of thought and belief into that deeper and more enduring level where all God's children got a song to sing, and it's our collective job to provide the chorus that can cradle all the many voices in its heart and accompany them with the music of the heavens, the rhythm of justice, and the beat of the human heart, all our human hearts, trying to find our way back home together, trying to find our way back home together, and to know the place for the first time.